Welcome into another live PFF College Football Show. Max Chabot alongside Dalton Wasserman previewing the biggest games of week three. And Dalton, we're up to six games now. Not five anymore, six games. Running out of room on the PFF desk right now for all the mini helmets, man. But it's a really fun week of college football that we have coming up in week three. Maybe not as loaded as previous weeks, but still a lot of enticing matchups that we're going to break down today.
Well, there's always chaos in the season of chaos, right? And just when we thought last week we wouldn't see anything crazy, we saw crazy all the way till 3 a.m. So it's very likely that we see something like that this week. We've got two big Friday games. We're previewing one of them. We've got a bunch of Saturday games that are a lot of fun, and you never know where it's going to go because that's just how college football works.
It absolutely is. And listen, the slates were always people look at it and say, oh, it's not really that many great games. That is when chaos always happens. That's when we always get the most chaotic weeks of college football. So even though the week three slate maybe on paper doesn't look as good as some other weeks we have coming up, it's still going to be a very chaotic week. And we have some still really great matchups we're going to break down today. And maybe, Dalton, the best matchup of the whole weekend is coming on Friday night. That is number 20, Arizona, at number 14, Kansas State. Like I said, Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern time on Fox. The storyline for this game, Dalton, is a fascinating one. This is one of the biggest Big 12 games of the year. But this technically isn't even a Big 12 game because this game, back in 2016, was scheduled as a home-and-home series between Arizona and Kansas State for this year and next year as a part of their non-conference schedule. Because remember, Arizona was a member of the Pac-12. At that point. So when Arizona moved to the Big 12, they kept this game as a non-conference game. So really, they're playing 10 games against Big 12 opponents, Arizona and K-State this year, while the rest of the conference plays nine. So while this is a massive game in terms of, you know, two of the four Big 12 teams are in the top 20, it's a massive game for determining who the real contenders are in the Big 12. It actually doesn't even affect the conference standings at all, which is pretty interesting.
Right. I mean, the most interesting part about it is if the Big 12 is going to be a league that gets more than one bid, then this could be a huge game for both teams. Let's say one of these teams makes the conference title game with a win in this game, even though it doesn't count towards the standings, and loses the conference title game. It helps their case big time for an at-large with them both being in the top 20, especially for Arizona being on the road in Manhattan. That's one of the hardest places to play in college football against a really good K-State team. This is huge. If especially with everything we've seen in the ACC, we kind of feel like it might just be a one-bid league. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Big 12 could sneak a second or even third team in there, but I think one of these, whichever team wins this game, has a much more likely chance of that happening for them.
The ACC and Notre Dame now suffering a bad loss. If Notre Dame loses again, you could absolutely see the Big 12 getting another team in there. So, Dalton, you had the Kansas State offense in this game against the Arizona's defense. What should we be watching out for when the Wildcats have the ball?
It's kind of the same thing. Actually, you mentioned the Wildcats.
They're both Wildcats.
When we were writing our preview, I was like, I can't use Wildcats either way. But no, the big thing is always K-State's running game, right? And you've got this dynamic three-headed monster of Avery Johnson, DJ Giddens, and now Dylan Edwards, the Colorado transfer, who I think has brought a real spark to them, just the speed and what he brings on the outside. Even as Giddens runs in between the tackles and Johnson with all his speed, both as a design runner and as a scrambler, you've got a three-headed rushing monster. And I think if you remember when we previewed at the beginning of the year, Florida State and Georgia Tech, and I talked about Florida State's linebackers, they're better with downhill runs and when they know where the ball's going and it's just a designed handoff. They're good at making plays in the hole, but they struggle a bit with option stuff and with getting east and west. I think that's the thing I'm looking for. Their two linebackers, Jacob Manu and Tay Brown, they're kind of those types of linebackers. They're downhill, they're big, they're physical, but they really sometimes they're looking in the backfield, right? And you see guys pulling, and Kansas State runs more gap schemes than any team in the country. So you've got a group that has to, one, read the offensive line and read guards and read pullers coming left and right. They're running counter, they're running power, they're just all over the place with options. Then you have the second dimension of Avery Johnson can keep the ball on any given play, and he can absolutely fly. He had five rushing touchdowns in a game last year against Texas Tech. He's a much more dynamic runner right now than he is as a passer, but especially for Arizona's linebackers, I could see this being a serious problem because I think their defensive line is playing well. I think their secondary is playing relatively well, but it's right on that second level where I start to worry about, okay, even some of the RPO stuff that K-State has in, it's not a complicated passing game, but it's a passing game that's also based around their running game. And all three of these guys can really, really run the ball. And Avery Johnson at the center of it as the option threat any given play, I think can cause Arizona a lot of problems. We saw even a couple weeks ago when they struggled with New Mexico. They didn't struggle with the designed handoff game and anything that was going to the running backs. They did struggle with quarterback runs. And Devin Dampier, I think he had almost 140 rushing yards in that game. If you struggle with running quarterbacks, K-State is not the team you want to play. So I think that's a very, very key matchup. It's just going to be all of K-State's run schemes against Arizona's linebackers in this game.
And not only that, I mean, yeah, Avery Johnson's a dangerous running threat, but also DJ Giddens has five straight games, at least 100 rushing yards. He's one of the best running backs in America. So that's a dangerous, dangerous run game that Arizona has to account for. And on the other side of the ball, Dolan, with Arizona, is their passing game that really is the driving force behind this team. My biggest matchup I'm looking for, though, can Arizona find someone outside of Tetro McMillan to rely on in this game? Tetro McMillan, make no mistake about it, is an absolute superstar. He's a top five prospect on PFF's big board right now, made by Trevor Sikkema. You can check it out at pff.com. Strong argument, he's the best receiver in college football right now. He really proved that in week one in the 61-39 victory over New Mexico. School record, 304 receiving yards and four touchdowns on 10 catches. He was completely unguardable one-on-one. Northern Arizona watched that tape, FCS school, and they said, okay, why would we want to play single coverage against the best receiver in the country when we're an FCS team? So what did they do in that game? They bracketed him every single freaking play. Every time he was out there, there was a corner and a safety that had their eyes on him and was going over to that side of the field the entire time. And they had great success doing that because Tedrick McMillan, after having 304 yards in week one, had two catches for 11 yards in week two. And with their top weapon neutralized, Arizona went from scoring 39 points over New Mexico, an FBS team, to 22 points against Northern Arizona, an FCS team. So Kansas State probably saw that and said, hey, we take away Tetro McMillan, Nova Fita is going to have to find someone outside of him to throw the ball to. So I think guys like tight end Keon Burnett, wide receiver Jeremiah Patterson, they're going to have to step up, I think, a little bit in this game. The issue for Kansas State, though, right now they're 79th in coverage grade this year at 69.7, so it hasn't been a great coverage unit for Kansas State. But really, the book is almost out on this Arizona offense, at least in the passing game. It's like, you take away number four, and Arizona can have a lot of issues. There isn't a Jacob Cowing this year. They don't have a really good number two receiver. That could present some problems for the Wildcats in this game.
Yeah, I agree, and I think another thing for them is going to be to run the ball with Ja'Cory Crosby-Merritt, with Kwali Conley. That's been big for them in the first couple weeks, having a little bit of balance, and they're going to need more of it. This is going to be a physical game, and I think you're right. If you're playing against Arizona, number four, that's number one right there. That's what it is. You have to double him. You have to rotate coverages towards him, and I think we will see whether K-State can make that happen, because against Tulane, even last week, they had a lot of issues in coverage. So it's obviously about trying to win with your best players, but Arizona is going to need more balance if they're going to succeed and make a Big 12 title run like we think they are.
Absolutely. So, Dolan, we have been all over Arizona all offseason. We both have them in the college football playoff right now. I haven't seen too many other playoff predictions with the Arizona Wildcats in the college football playoff, so a lot is riding on this game for us, you know, with our predictions preseason. Does Arizona go into Manhattan, Kansas, and pull off a massive victory, or does Kansas State establish themselves as one of the best teams, if not the best team, in the Big 12?
This is such a tough game to pick because we have such contrasting styles, right? You have a three-headed rushing monster against the classic quarterback receiver dynamic, and I just think in Manhattan, I still think Arizona can and will win the Big 12. But this is not a good matchup for them. And I think there are other matchups in the Big 12, even against the better running teams, that I think they can learn from this game. And I actually have Kansas State winning this game.
Wow, okay.
I think it's going to be high scoring. I think it's going to be really close. But the things that you just mentioned where Arizona needs someone else to step up, right? Or unless Fifita and McMillan just go crazy like they did 2 weeks ago, always a possibility with them. But they need. It feels like, looking at this matchup, there's a lot of ifs, plus they're on the road on a Friday night, right? Mm-hmm. They need somebody else. They need to have a better-than-expected rushing performance. Or Noah Fifita just needs to be special in this game, which he could be. He very well could be. We still think he's one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the country. But I look at Kansas State, And I watch them and I go, on offense at least, they just need to be themselves, right? And it's Avery Johnson, it's DJ Giddens, it's Dylan Edwards. And one more stat about linebackers. Last year, opposing linebackers against Kansas State across the whole season had a 42 run defense grade.
Wow.
One of the hardest things in college football to do is play linebacker against this defense. It's going to be a huge key. Now, I'll admit to you, if Arizona has a plan and they find any way to stop the run against Kansas State, they could very well win this. I think it's a coin flip game, honestly. I think I could rely on picking Kansas State's foundation in this specific matchup a little bit more. And I really think Dylan Edwards makes a big difference, because last year you had Will Howard and you had Avery Johnson kind of rotating in, and then you just had Giddens. I think Edwards is a really big piece of this offense, adding a speed dimension, adding an outside dimension to what Giddens already gives you between the tackles. 34-30, I have Kansas State.
34-30, I'm taking Arizona in this game, 30-27. I think that K-State secondary is a little vulnerable, and I think you got one of the best quarterbacks in the country, like you said, Noah Fifita, and maybe the best receiver in college football in Tetro McMillan. They could take advantage of that. And I do think if Kansas State doubles McMillan every play, Fifita might be able to find some other guys in this game. I also think a great call by you, Kwali Conley has been a really impressive player through 2 weeks so far. He's a guy that I think could also have a good day against Kansas State if they really try to bracket McMillan every single play. So I got Arizona. I'm sticking with our big preseason Big 12 champion, 30-27 in this game. But it is an absolute nail-biter for me coming down to it. And Dawn, you and I forgot to mention at the top, you and I have the same record in game picks this year at 10-2. So this could be one that that determines who takes the lead in that game picks right now. So I got Arizona 30-27, and this game's going to be a great game, and I can't wait for that on Friday night. Maybe the best game of the weekend is on Friday night, so I can't wait for that one. Next game we're talking about is where College Game Day is going. That is number 16 LSU at South Carolina, which is at noon Eastern time on ABC. My storyline I'm kind of looking for in this game, can LSU get back on track? Because to put it simply, LSU hasn't had the best start to his 2024 season. They began with a 27-20 loss to number 23 USC. That was a game that LSU had the lead with 6 minutes left. And then in week two, they played Nichols in kind of a get-right game. They were 46.5-point favorites. They only led them by 2 points with under 10 minutes left before pulling away for a 44-21 victory. So they obviously lost week one against USC, and then in week two against an FCS opponent, they didn't look great either. Now you go into South Carolina, like I said before, hosting College Game Day. First time in a decade that South Carolina is hosting College Game Day. Gamecocks right now 2-0 on the season, coming off a dominant 31-6 victory on the road over Kentucky, despite the fact that South Carolina was 9.5-point underdog. So you got a program in South Carolina that's on the rise seemingly right now, and a program at LSU that kind of looks a little shaky through 2 weeks right now. So I'm really looking forward to seeing, can LSU get back on track against Gamecocks?
I'm going to be honest, if you're trying to get back on track, I don't know if that this is the team you want to play. There's a lot of excitement around South Carolina right now. Obviously, you're going to talk about their defense, but there's some young talent that's coming through for them. We've talked about Dylan Stewart. Their quarterback, Lenora Sellers, is slowly getting it together. I think this is a very dangerous game for LSU, and I think South Carolina, they pose a big threat, honestly, on both sides of the ball, but especially their defense, I'm really, really impressed with.
So, Dawn, you have the South Carolina offense in this game. So what should we be looking out for with Lenora Sellers leading the way?
Yeah, kind of the curious thing to me is we figured with Lenora Sellers at quarterback and with Rocket Sanders at running back, we figured they're going to be run heavy, and they are kind of run heavy. But the best moments in this offense come from Lenora Sellers' arm and throwing down the field. And honestly, I think an ideal scenario for South Carolina's offense is they operate a lot like Alabama with Jalen Milroe, and you have kind of this high variance, super strong armed quarterback. Man, he can hit 70 yards in pads. I'm telling you, he's probably got one of the six or eight strongest arms in the country, on top of a 240 pound frame that he can run with. But that's what I'm seeing. And if you look at Sellers' passing grade on the surface, it's a 60.2. Part of that is because he fumbled the ball 3 times in the pocket last week. And if you take out those 3 fumbles, it's actually a 77.4, which is pretty darn good for a redshirt freshman through 2 starts, right? So you've got a guy who I think that's where his talents are. And if you look so far in his career at a handful of reps last year and 2 games this year, 10-plus yard throws, a 92.8 passing grade, which is really good. South Carolina is not the most consistent offense. And their best moments are coming when Sellers hits home runs. It can be from the pocket. It can be on the move. He still has to work on making just kind of sometimes working through his reads and taking throws that aren't the home runs, right? If you have a 15-yard crosser that's open, then just take it. There's something he's working on it, right? There's a lot of things. He's a young kid. He's going to work on it. He doesn't have a ton of reps. But he can hit home runs. I can tell you that right now. And if there's one thing LSU does on defense since the start of last year, they give up a lot of home runs. Okay, since the start of last year, they're tied for 54th among 70 Power 5 teams in coverage grade, and they've given up 88 receptions of 15 or more yards in that span, the sixth most in the Power 5. LSU, it's a problem we've seen since last year. Too many big plays given up from their secondary, and I think LSU obviously has the more consistent offense. We know what they're going to get, but South Carolina's offense, it's a work in progress, but I can tell you right now, Sellers can make any throw on the field, and he is willing to make any throw. He does not hold back. It's very much, I think it in style, it's very much like Jalen Milroe, where it's high variance, and there's plays during it. There was a throw he made against Old Dominion that actually was dropped. I forget who dropped it, but it was close to 70 yards in the air. It was the ball Anthony Richardson threw in the Colts game this weekend. Sellers made just about that same throw two weeks ago against Old Dominion, and it was dropped. It would have been, like, I think, like a 92-yard touchdown or somewhere in that range. It was insane how good his arm is, and he's willing to take those shots, and LSU needs to be better in the secondary because all it takes with big bombs like that is two or three of them, and you turn a game upside down, especially with as well as South Carolina's defense is playing.
I can't wait to watch Lenore Sellers against that defense, Dolan, but the one thing I cannot wait to watch in this game is Dylan Stewart against the best tackle duo in the country. So just kind of a peek behind the curtain here at the PFF College Football Show. Every week, you and I send to Eli, our producer, the guys we should put in the background of this. And usually, it's the big-name players, the quarterbacks of this game, the head coach of this game. For this game, we said, nah, put the left tackle for LSU and put the edge rusher for South Carolina, because this is maybe the most must-see matchup of the entire weekend and maybe the most must-see matchup of the entire season so far. This kid, Dolan, Dylan Stewart, has been nothing short of spectacular through his first two college games. Former five-star recruit, by the way, Dylan Stewart.
You win this one.
He leads all edge defenders in college football with a 90.5 PFF grade and a 94 pass rushing grade as well, while also tying for first among all defensive players in the country with two forced fumbles. You and I were talking to Trevor Sycamore, our lead draft analyst, recently, and he told us, if Dylan Stewart was able to get drafted this year, he would be my number one edge defender, and he would be a top 10 pick in the draft. This kid is 18 years old, and he's doing this kind of things. The Old Dominion game was awesome. He had like an unreal PFF grade in that one. It was like, okay, it's Old Dominion. Let's see what he can do against Kentucky. And there were a few plays against Kentucky, Dolan, where he was getting triple teamed and still got to Brock Vandegrift. And it was like, this kid is freaking special. Man, he's probably the best edge rusher South Carolina's had since Jadeveon Clowney, honestly. And this early, we're saying that about him, which is nuts. 6'6", 248 pounds, ridiculous bend. That bend allows him to deploy a ghost move that looks unblockable through 2 weeks of college football so far. But this is the time now to show up against the big guys. Will Campbell, the best offensive tackle in college football. My number one and your number one tackle entering the season. Top 10 prospect on PFF's big board for the 2025 NFL Draft. The number one offensive lineman in the 2025 NFL Draft as well. So when you're going on the left side, you got Will Campbell. On the right side, you got Emory Jones Jr., who entered the year as my number nine offensive tackle in the country and currently is a first-round prospect on PFF's big board as well. So you got a first-round left tackle, a first-round right tackle against maybe already the best pass rusher in college football, and Dylan Stewart. I cannot freaking wait to watch Dylan Stewart against Will Campbell and Emory Jones, man. Get your popcorn out now, because that is going to be the most musty matchup of the entire weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, Dylan Stewart's great, and it's not just him. It's Tonka Hemingway. It's TJ Sanders. It's Kyle Kennard. It's Brian Thomas Jr. is the son of former Jet great Brian Thomas. I mean, they're loaded. I don't know when all of a sudden they collected all this talent on their defensive line, but Max, I'm going to be honest with you, watching them, I came into this South Carolina tape watch thinking, okay, they're kind of upstart, it's a fun 2-0, and maybe Kentucky played really bad. I honestly think if we redid our top 10 defensive lines as units, I think South Carolina's would be in the top five.
Might be.
All right. I really do. They're loaded. As Stewart is incredible, and that depth of guys, and the big thing too that to me makes them even better. You watch them; they don't blitz at all. I had to go look into it. They have the single lowest blitz rate in the entire country right now. They can do anything they want in coverage and mess around in coverage with their back seven because they can just send any four of those guys.
Yep.
And they will get, and they're getting home, right? I mean, they were just unblockable against Kentucky and really against Old Dominion too. They, as long as their offense can just keep them in manageable situations. If you fall behind South Carolina, you have a major problem with this pass rush. This is already one of the best defensive lines in the country. I think as a unit, not just Stewart against those two tackles, but the entire front against LSU's offensive line. You know, we usually think, oh, the big tests come against Bama and Georgia. This is a huge test for LSU's offensive line. It might be the battle that decides this game.
Absolutely. And yeah, I didn't even mention Kyle Kennard too. He has had a great start to his season as well. Yeah. So yeah, that South Carolina D-line is outstanding against one of the best O-lines in the country and the best tackle duo in the country. Like I said, two first-round tackles. It's incredibly rare that a school can have that. So I'm really excited to see that matchup. Dalton, does LSU escape Columbia with a victory, or with College Game Day there, does South Carolina get a massive win for this program?
The more I watch South Carolina's defense, the more I think this game is a toss-up. And the big problem I have is LSU's leading rusher, John Emery, being out for the season. Yep. I think if you're going to beat South Carolina, Kentucky ran for a lot of yards on them. I think it was over 260 yards on them last week. They're going to make you run the ball. And LSU, to be honest, doesn't want to run the ball. They didn't even run the ball last week against an FCS opponent, Nichols. Right? They just had Garrett Nussmeier go out and get hot in the fourth quarter, and they finally pulled away late. I'm worried about this game if I'm LSU. I'm looking at this defense and the way they don't give you the same look in coverage two plays in a row. This is an elite pass rush. They don't blitz at all. They don't have to. This is an elite pass rush. That's a whole different problem than LSU has seen so far. They didn't see this even against USC. This is a different animal. This South Carolina defense is emerging. And if LSU, there's two things they have to do in this game. And the problem is it's the two things that they're not particularly great at. Run the ball, and they've already lost their starting running back, and prevent big plays. And obviously, that's high variance and deep ball and all of that. I'm taking the Gamecocks.
Wow.
I'm going to take them in a low-ish scoring game, 20-17. I really think if LSU wins this game, they need their offensive line to be special because this is going to be a battle. And then they need Garrett Nussmeier to be special. I don't know that they're going to be willing. Because the problem for LSU, especially without Emery now, we saw a couple of weeks ago, they ran the ball well against USC. But I think USC was okay with that. They would rather have that than Nussmeier making big throws on them. This game, I think, is another example. I know, look, LSU, and Garrett Nussmeier might just go out there. Maybe he'll go out there and prove us wrong and throw, prove me wrong, I should say, and throw four or five touchdowns. But that's the only way they can win this game. I don't know. I think the more LSU turns and hands the ball off, I think South Carolina's fine with it. Because Nussmeier's really good. I mean, I think this would be a game that if he has to carry them through this, that gets into NFL scouts' rooms with the tape, because this is a really good defense. Look, South Carolina, they're developing on offense, and if they're going to win, they're going to win a game that's like 20-17 like this if they're pulling this off. But I think their defense is capable of it. I'm super impressed with them, and I think the fact Nussmeier's grade actually against the blitz is a lot higher than it is when teams aren't blitzing. South Carolina's not going to blitz at all. They don't need to. So now you've got freaks up front. I'm telling, and it's not just Dylan Stewart. You've got a whole crew of freaks up front. I'm going to take South Carolina and the defense at home to win a low scoring game, 20-17.
That's really shocking. I can't believe you actually took South Carolina. I love it though. I do think it'll be a good game. I have LSU winning this game though, 31-21. I think the Tigers are going to win there and win. I think Garrett Nussmeier will be good enough, and also the Lenore Sellers stuff. He looks good through 2 weeks. I want to see more, and I trust Garrett Nussmeier and that offense for LSU. Even though it's against great defense in South Carolina that is better than LSU's, I trust them more than I trust Lenora Sellers right now. So I think after two disappointing performances to start the year, LSU kind of regains its footing a little bit and beats South Carolina.
The big element for me, the difference between the two is I do believe Nussmeier is going to keep his composure. Yeah. I think that's the biggest reason LSU would go and win this game is because Nussmeier, he's very composed, and he's gotten better than he used to be at taking what the defense gives him and just diagnosing and not forcing big throws. I think a huge element in this game is Sellers doing the same. If Sellers keeps his composure and he's not fumbling and he's not turning the ball over and maybe not just even just sometimes not trying to force deep shots when he doesn't, because there's flashes on the tape when it's like, okay, he takes some of the easier throws and, yep. And he's just 100-mile-an-hour arm, Max. I mean, what an arm he's got. He can make, he has the ability to make any throw on the field. I think as long as he stays composed, especially early in the game, just play that grinding, slow, wear them down defensive game and be a part of that. And, you know, and for South Carolina, it's a game where be content to punt the ball. You don't have to force things early on your own 40 and things like that. I think if they get into one of those fist fight drag out games, I really think South Carolina can win it. But that's the part I would worry about is I know Nussmeier, he's very composed in big spots. I think he's going to keep his composure. It's going to be tight. It's going to be really, really tight. And that matchup you talked about of LSU's O-line versus South Carolina's deal, that's movie theater stuff. That's great.
I can't wait for that. Dalton, you and I entered this week with the same record in our predictions, again, at 10-2. And we differ on the first two games.
Yeah, I'll be ahead of you.
Okay, we'll see. I'm taking the underdog in the Arizona game. You're taking the underdog in the South Carolina game. We'll see if we differ on this game, though. That is number 4, Alabama at Wisconsin. Another noon game on Fox. The storyline to know for this game is, okay, was that game against USF, was it a fluke for Alabama like it was last year? Because for the second year in a row, Alabama's game against USF came down to the wire. And you made the joke to me when we were watching the game upstairs, like, Alabama will never, ever schedule South Florida.
There's something about the Bulls in Tampa. There's something about them.
They'll never do it again. Listen, the Crimson Tide had a 5-point lead over South Florida with under 6 minutes to go before scoring 3 straight touchdowns to get a 42-16 win, ironically almost covered the spread. Even though they had a 5-point lead with they entered the game with 33.5-point favorites. They almost covered the spread, winning by 26 in this game. Last year, the Crimson Tide beat South Florida 17-3 in what was a one-score game before Alabama scored a touchdown with under a minute left in that one. And many, and remember, you were on the show too, including us, we were saying, oh boy, this Crimson Tide offense is in trouble. And we don't know if they can make the college football playoff. We don't know if they're a playoff contender anymore. After that, though, Nick Saban and Jalen Milroe rattled off 10 straight victories, including an SEC championship win over Georgia to make the college football playoff. So the question is, okay, last year's game against South Florida was proven to be a fluke. Is this year's game against South Florida proven to be a fluke again? And can Kalen DeBoer and Jalen Milroe have the same success as Milroe and Saban did last year?
I think they will. I think Alabama's going to come out and look better. There's just got to be something about USF, right? Like I don't know what. I know they have Byron Brown. And it's funny because in those two games, USF has played better defense than basically at any point in the last year and a half. It's the strangest thing. Like, their two best games on defense, except maybe the bowl game against Cuse, because, well, I had to bring that up, have come against Alabama. So, I mean, it's a strange dynamic. And last year there was a bit of the excuse, too, where they benched Milroe for that game.
Right.
This time they had Milroe in there, and it still was kind of ugly. And I think the one thing with Milroe that USF did, they learned from Michigan, is they blitzed him mm-hmm. a lot. And I think that's a big key. That could be a big key in this game against Milroe if Wisconsin decides to send heavy pressure.
Dalton, the other quarterback in this game is Tyler Van Dyke, and honestly, Wisconsin hasn't looked great in their first two games either. So what should we be looking out for when Wisconsin and TVD have the ball?
So Tyler Van Dyke's got a huge arm too, yep. right? He's another quarterback with just an absolute cannon for an arm. I just don't know who can win downfield so he can use it. Through two games against South Dakota and Western Michigan, they have completed 2 passes that have gone at least 15 yards in the air, and both of them were against South Dakota with like major coverage busts. Especially there was the first one, I believe, that might have gone for a touchdown. Basically, they just forgot to cover the receiver. So it's a problem. It's been a problem since Wisconsin has gone to more of a spread offense, and they used to get in the eye on fullbacks and tight ends and all of that. But they're having a problem winning downfield, and you look at them since the start of last year, they're just in receiving grade and reception, everything downfield just not working. 15-plus yard receptions, Max. They only have 36 since the start of last year, 15th fewest in the Power 5. 54th out of 70 in receiving grade. They don't get a lot of yards after the catch. I'm watching the Western Michigan tape and going, who's getting open here? They didn't complete a single ball over 15 yards. Who gets open downfield? Because this is the problem is you have receivers that can't separate downfield. But you have a quarterback that really his strength is throwing it vertically. Yeah. The best throws that we saw from him at Miami we're downfield and standing in the pocket and kind of that old school. I mean, I think about guys like Brad Johnson and pocket quarterbacks like that that want to zip it down the field. They just – it looks so far like they don't have the weapons. Very much like last year when they were 113th in receiving grade, they don't make big plays. And I understand it's Wisconsin and they're a cold weather team and offensive line and running the ball and all of that, but they're trying to spread it out more. The problem is – it feels like defenses aren't taking that as much of a threat. There are reps when Western Michigan's in man coverage, and they're the ones winning.
Yeah.
And honestly, without some mistakes on Western Michigan's part, they may have lost that game. So I think Wisconsin has a problem creating big plays, and Alabama for years and years, even now without Nick Saban, but with Nick Saban, they're one of the best teams at preventing explosive plays, right? That's the one thing they do is make you work for it, right? So, look, they were second in the nation in coverage grade last year. They're sixth. They're tied for sixth through two games this year. I don't think Alabama's secondary and their back end's going anywhere. They have a ton of good athletes, and I don't know that they're going to have a particularly hard time figuring out a way to cover these Wisconsin receivers.
The biggest weakness in our team preview for Wisconsin Angry of the Year was pretty obvious. It was the receiving core, and it's proven to be the case so far. So, yeah, that's definitely a matchup to look out for. And on the other side of the ball, it's almost the same thing. Jalen Milroe and Alabama's receivers against a pretty good Wisconsin secondary. So we mentioned Milroe before. He really struggled to do anything against South Florida this past week. He had a 50.7 overall grade, 49.5 passing grade. That's the lowest he's had over the last 2 years. You got to go back all the way when he was a backup to Bryce Young to find lower grades for Milroe, honestly. And he consistently, in that game against South Florida, missed deep receivers time after time after time. And once again, was rough against the blitz. 44.7 passing grade against the blitz, which was 44.7 in this game. And last year, he was 85th among FBS quarterbacks against the blitz with a 62.5 passing grade. And also doesn't help that the Alabama offensive line, which hand up, I called the best in the country entering the year, they're currently 105th in team pass blocking grade. Now, I will say, though, Caden Proctor has not played yet. And Kalen DeBoer did say that he could be returning this week against Wisconsin. You bring him back, one of the better offensive tackles that we have in college football, as a huge return for them. But the receiving core is a little worrisome as well, because right now Ryan Williams is really the only receiver that has been consistent for Alabama. He's a 17-year-old freshman. He's the only receiver for Alabama with 80 receiving yards for the Crimson Tide this year. So that's a little worrisome for this Alabama passing game as of right now. And then Wisconsin defensively, they blitz at about an average rate. Right now they blitz at about a 38% rate, which is tied for 57th in the country. However, if Luke Fickell decides to send the house a little bit more against Milroe, they have the secondary that can bother these Alabama receivers. They entered the year with one of my 10 best secondaries in college football. They have star players like Hunter Waller and Ricardo Hallman as well. This is a really good secondary for Wisconsin that I think if Wisconsin blitzes Milroe and gets after him, they can bother him a little bit in this game, and that could be the recipe for Wisconsin to keep this a low-scoring game and maybe have a shot at winning this game.
Yeah, I agree, and I think Bama, they're kind of figuring it out in the passing game, but the blitz thing is a problem because it's been a problem since last year, both protecting the blitz.
Michigan won that game up just by blitzing Milroe, basically.
They've had problems protecting against the blitz for multiple years, and Milroe just doesn't get rid of the ball quickly like that. It's been shown time and again that he needs that three and a half seconds to get back and take his time and think about whether he's going to pass or run, and sometimes he's going to scramble. If you speed him up, There it really isn't any quick game in Alabama's offense, not with Milroe at least. So you're right, it's absolutely a problem, and I'd be very curious to see if Fickell ratchets that back up.
Yeah, so Dolan, you and I have disagreed on both games that we've previewed so far. Will we disagree on this one? Who do you have winning in Madison, Wisconsin?
I think this is a really bad matchup for Wisconsin. I do, unless somebody like a Will Pauling or a Bryson Green plays out of their absolute mind and shows us a level of football we haven't seen before. I've got Alabama 35-10. I just think Wisconsin is going to have a hard time scoring against Bama, especially when you consider they've had a reasonably hard time scoring against a Western Michigan and a South Dakota so far. I mean, even 27 points against South Dakota last week, and it was inconsistent, and some of that was due to South Dakota mistakes. There isn't a whole lot about this Wisconsin offense that I feel like is dynamic. At least I feel like with Bama, I know there's Milroe, and the receivers are potentially dynamic. We've seen some of that from Ryan Williams, Kobe Prentice last week, Jeremy Bernard. They're working on it, essentially, right? But Wisconsin, they weren't explosive last year, and they're not explosive now. And I'm not sure how they're going to score a lot of points in this game unless Alabama really – they're young in the secondary, so maybe they can scheme something up. But just man for man, I have a hard time seeing how Wisconsin's going to score a lot of points.
I'm with you. I really struggle seeing how Wisconsin can win this game unless it's like a 13-10 type game, honestly. So that's why I have Alabama winning this game 27-13. I do think the Wisconsin defense will force a few mistakes from Milroe that can make it a close game in the first half. But then he and the Crimson Tide, I think, will pull away in the second half when Tyler Van Dyke just can't really get anything going for that Wisconsin offense. And the Wisconsin defense is on the field for a lot of that game, and they can get gassed out, honestly. And at that point, Milroe will start to find Ryan Williams deep and something like that and end up winning this game by two scores. So I got Alabama winning that game 27-13, the first game that you and I are actually agreeing on, Dolan, in this preview. Next game we're talking about, though, is the only other ranked game besides Arizona and Kansas State. It is number 24 Boston College at number 6 Missouri, 12:45 p.m. Eastern Time on SEC Network. The storyline for this game, this is the first real test for Missouri. Don't get me wrong, Missouri has looked awesome through two games. In fact, Dalton, they're the first FBS team since 2019 to have two straight shutouts to start their season. Right now, Missouri is outscoring their opponents 89-0 so far. So because of that start, Missouri, the start of the year at number 11, is now all the way up to number 6 in the AP poll. But as impressive as they've looked, it's important to remember they played Murray State, which is an FCS school, and Buffalo, who went 3-9 in the MAC last season. So not necessarily the toughest competition just yet. Boston College should present the first real challenge for Missouri, as they're currently number 24 in the country, doing great under Bill O'Brien in his debut as Boston College's head coach. They have a 2-0 record right now. They beat Florida State in week one as well. So I'm really excited to see Missouri for the first real time this year truly get tested.
Yeah, and watching their first two games, I don't even think they played their best football, and they still won 89-0 across the two games. I think there was some mistakes, especially offensively. It sounds funny because, well, they scored 89 points, but it actually hasn't been the most crisp execution yet on offense. And I think what I'm looking for is Brady Cook. There's a lot of downfield shots that he's actually missed through the first two games. And I wonder, maybe not sleepwalking, but they have almost very casually won these first two games without playing their best football. Now, really encouraged by their offensive line, really encouraged by their Toriano Pride and their secondary. Obviously, they have a boatload of weapons that just can dominate teams like that at probably 60% speed. Honestly, Missouri's absolutely loaded, but I don't even think they've played their best football yet. But you don't want to go out against a team like BC, mm-hmm. who's running hot, who went down to Tallahassee and dominated Florida State. They didn't just win. They were the better team from start to finish in all 60 minutes in that game. So maybe there's a switch that gets flipped, but it's certainly a new challenge for Missouri right now, even though they look very, very good through these first two games.
So, Dolan, you have the Missouri side of the football in this game with so many stars, obviously Kirby Moore, Brady Cook, Luther Burden III. What should we be looking out for when the Missouri offense is going with the Boston College defense?
I got to be honest. Unless you're an elite coverage team on the level of a Georgia or something like that, I'm not really sure how you slow down all of these weapons that Missouri has. When you talk about Luther Burden, Marquise Johnson, Mookie Cooper, Theo Weiss, Norfleet, Marcus Carroll, Nate Noel, it just weapons, and Brady Cook's feet too. I mean, they have so many weapons, right? And you can't just line up and go, oh yeah, we'll shut them down. That's not a thing. I think the most effective way to do it, and what I want to see, is how much pressure Boston College defensive coordinator Tim Lewis applies to Brady Cook, because his numbers in his career against the blitz are just not quite as good. And since the start of last year, just a 68.3 passing grade against the blitz with 9 big time throws and 6 turnover worthy plays, that's just about 14 points lower than his passing grade against the standard rush. So I think what you do, and a lot of times too, when Cook gets blitzed, he's more inclined to run, he's more inclined to beat it himself instead of throwing over it, and he doesn't throw on the move a whole lot. So I think that's the way to do it. I think I want to see Boston College so far has blitzed at like an above average rate, right around 40% on pass plays. Not the highest rate in the country by any means, but I think it's somewhere in the top 40 or 50 if I remember right. That's, I think you have to stop Brady Cook, and I think you have to force the action and make him do something at a speed that maybe he doesn't want to do. Because if you send four, and this is a good offensive line led by Connor Tolleson at center, you know, even though they lost Javon Foster, I think their offensive line and even their run game has looked really, really good. But if you get an obvious passing downs and you send four and you let all these weapons Missouri has just go and run free, good luck.
Yeah.
I don't think the answer is how do we cover Missouri. The answer to me is how much do we disturb Brady Cook? And I want to see if Tim Lewis goes out there and does that. If they amp it up, if they're saving all – and they run – their blitzes, there's some complicated stuff in there. There's disguises. They'll show you one and then go with the other. They'll show you zero and drop out and send whichever guy. Like, there are things that cause problems in protection. But I think Boston College, it's almost like they have to gamble and just go, you know what? I don't know that we can cover them. I believe in our guys, but that's a bunch of freaks they have, especially at receiver. I mean, at four or five different guys at receiver, a good tight end, two backs. You have to stop the run, too. I think Missouri's well over 400 rushing yards in the first two games as well. So Marcus Carroll and Nate Noel in the run game. But I think in moments where they get Missouri, say in a 3rd-and-7, 3rd-and-8, they have to gamble, they have to get after him, and they have to make him make throws under pressure.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you got to contain that Missouri pass game if you're Missouri. Or Boston College, and then on the other side of the ball with Missouri, you got to contain this run game for Boston College. A dangerous, dangerous run game for the Eagles. Right now, Dolan, Boston College has run the ball on almost 67% of their plays this year. That is the highest rate among Power 4 schools. The Eagles have a four-headed monster in that backfield with Treshawn Ward, Kai Robichaux, and Turbo Richard. Each of them have over 100 rushing yards through two games this year. Excuse me, the three running backs have over 100 rushing yards. Thomas Castellanos, the quarterback, is right behind them with 71 rushing yards. Last year, Castellanos had 1,222 rushing yards, second in the country among quarterbacks. The only one who had more was the Heisman Trophy winner in Jaden Daniels. So Thomas Castellanos, by all stretches, is one of the best mobile quarterbacks in the country. And if Missouri stacks the box to stop the run, Castellanos also has the capability to win with his arm, because with Bill O'Brien in there now, I know it's only two games, he's looked a heck of a lot better than what he looked like last year. Right now, Dolan, actually, Thomas Castellanos has a 94.4 passing grade. That leads all quarterbacks in the country. Last year, he was 128th in the country with a 57.7 passing grade. So Thomas Castellanos, under Bill O'Brien, who's known for being this quarterback whisperer, has really improved as a passer, which makes that ground game all the more hard to stop, because now you can't just stack the box against this rushing attack. Now you have to be accounting for this aerial attack for Boston College as well. I will say Missouri's been really stout against the run. They've only allowed 3.2 yards per attempt, which is 20th in the country. But again, like we said before, Murray State and Buffalo, this is not the Boston College rushing attack they've gone against yet. So this Eagles backfield is going to test Missouri more than they've been tested all year. And again, you can't just stack the box, because Castellanos has proven that he can win with his arm now too.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a big thing that works in Boston College's favor is when they're on schedule, right? When they're in those 3rd-and-3s, 3rd-and-4s. We saw a lot of that against Florida State of, okay, when they were in 3rd-and-8, 3rd-and-10, it wasn't going as well for them. They're not designed to necessarily always drop back and throw the football. And Castellanos is a lower volume pass. I think, did he only throw? I don't think he threw 20.
Like 35 dropbacks total.
Yeah,
so not a lot.
So it's definitely more about his legs and the run game. But he needs to be efficient when he needs to be. And if they can stay ahead of schedule and they're in 3rd-and-3s, well, then you can design easier throws for them. They're not going to be the team that throws over the top all the time, not unless they're taking a play-action shot off of everything they have going on in the backfield. But that's going to be a big premium for me in this game, is Boston College staying ahead of the chains on early downs. If they get in 3rd-and-10, then Missouri's at a big advantage, I think.
So, Dolan, in one of the only ranked games that we have on the slate this weekend, does Missouri pass their first true test of the season, or does Boston College come in and pull off a major upset?
And it's certainly not the ranked game that we came into the year expecting, is it, at all? I mean, props to Boston College for getting off to a good start. But, no, I like Missouri. I think Missouri's the better team, and I know they've played lesser competition. I think their defense has looked lights out, even in spite of that, especially in the secondary. The run game, the balance in their run game is big for me. Their offensive line's playing really well. I think Marcus Carroll and Nate Noel are a really – they got both of them in the transfer portal. I think it's a really fun pair, because it's a little bit different than Cody Schrader. Cody Schrader was a hammer. He had a little more of just a straight-ahead, physical, run-you-over approach, right? These two guys add a little more shiftiness to it. There's a little more open field ability. it's different. It's a little bit different. So I think the balance in the run game, regardless, it was something that made them really good last year. It opens things up for these receivers. I think Missouri's the better team. I think the weapons are going to assert themselves. And the only thing I want to see is just Brady Cook just be a little more pinpoint than he's looked the first 2 weeks. Because despite them shutting out the first two opponents and outscoring them 89-0, I don't think he's played his best football yet. Because the play calls are there. Kirby Moore, yeah. We talked about him last year. Kirby Moore is incredible, especially in the passing game. Just calling up deep shots when he needs them, working. Kirby Moore, might scheme guys open right now better than almost any play caller in the country. So I think that's not going to be an issue. It's just going to be a matter of if Boston College can get pressure to Brady Cook and if Brady Cook can just make the big throws when they're available.
So you got that.
I have them 35-24, Missouri. So.
I almost have the same exact score as you. I have Missouri 34-21 in this game. I think the offensive firepower is too much for Boston College to handle, and I think they'll be able to handle Castellanos enough in this game.
And we've talked about a lot about different guys, Tedero, McMillan, Travis Hunter, Jeremiah Smith, right? We've yet to get the big Luther Burden game.
Oh, yeah. We're due.
You got to think it's coming. We're due for a big Luther Burden game.
I think he will be a big factor in this game. So I got Missouri win this one 34-21. Like I said, in your breakdown, I think it's just too much for them to handle in this game. And I think the defense will do enough against Thomas Castellanos, which is a dangerous ground game. And Bill O'Brien, like I said, has done a masterful job of improving Castellanos as a passer, although limited on limited dropbacks, but still looks really good when he is dropping back to pass. But I think Missouri will kind of end the little Cinderella run that we've had for Boston College so far and win this game. Next one we're talking about, Dawn, is Tulane at number 15, Oklahoma. This game is at 3:30 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN. The storyline to know in this game is, how does Oklahoma respond after a scare against Houston this past weekend? Oklahoma entered that Houston game as 27.5-point favorites. They only beat Houston by 4. And it was a game where the Sooners were on defense with just a 2-point lead and under 2 minutes left, where Donovan Smith had an opportunity to lead them down the field and take the lead and maybe win the game. But Oklahoma's defense came up big and scored a safety to seal the victory. And the week before, you got to remember, UNLV dominated Houston by a score of 27-7. Oklahoma can't afford to look this sloppy this week against Tulane. This past weekend, Tulane, against a really good team in Kansas State, took them down on the wire and only lost by a touchdown. And in fact, in that game, Tulane had the ball on the 16-yard line with 12 seconds left before throwing an interception in the end zone. So they could have tied that game and went to overtime, and they threw a pick in the end zone to lose the game. And now Kansas State is ranked one spot higher than Oklahoma. So if you just look at the AP poll, it stands to reason, hey, Tulane played that well against Kansas State. They could do that well against Oklahoma as well. So I'm excited to see, how does Oklahoma respond after a rough game against Houston? And can Tulane continue this and still play like a really close competition against a top 15 team?
Tell you what, when we talked about Tulane in the preseason, we were a little worried with all the talent they had leaving and Willie Fritz going to Houston and John Summerall coming in from Troy. We were worried about, what they might look like with Michael Pratt gone, who had started the last 4 years. And I think the most interesting thing is we were looking through all the starting quarterbacks. We were trying to figure out all the quarterback competitions, right, about first, second week of August. And we thought for sure it was going to be Ty Thompson, the transfer
easily
from Oregon.
Because he's a five-star.
And there was I remember it was like maybe the first or second week of August, and I mentioned to you, I said, there's whispers that they're going to start this redshirt freshman, Darian Mensah. People around New Orleans are saying, they're like, he's getting the first team reps.
And me being the five-star lover, I was like, no way.
Yeah.
Ty Thompson's a five-star.
And they named him the starter, and they have no reason to turn back. And
no.
I'm just going to dive right into the matchup. Look, Mensah's looked really good, and he's been a really good compliment. Look, the engine of this Tulane offense is their star running back, Mekhi Hughes. Okay, he's the engine. What Darian Mensah has done is just come in and played great complementary football. And you mentioned, look, they had a lead. They had a 10-point lead on Kansas State.
They did.
What Mensah does is complement Hughes with just tremendous play-action passing. That 91.2 passing grade on play-action is right now the 8th best mark in the country. He is absolutely killing it on play-action. You could see it against Kansas State last week. Kansas State was lost in play because you have to step up and respect Hughes. And right now, especially down the middle of the field, Mensah's making all of the throws down the middle. When they've got deep crossers and they've got times to take shots, when linebackers step up and even safeties are all over the place, they are taking shots downfield on play action. He is complimenting Hughes and the rest of this offense so well. You got guys at receiver like Mario Williams, now the transfer from USC. They are making things happen down the field, and it's a part of Oklahoma's defense that they've got a lot of really talented players on defense, but it's not something they handle the best. Okay, last season they ranked 31st out of 70 Power 5 teams in coverage grade against play action, which is kind of, obviously it's like mediocre, 31 out of 70. So far this season it's 59th. And if you go back and look at Houston last week, and they didn't score a ton of points, they only scored 12 points, but pretty much all of Houston's best plays came on play action. And Oklahoma, they have really good players, but they have players who are really aggressive to the ball, right? We think about Billy Bowman and Danny Stutzman and guys in the middle of the field like that. Those guys are going to have to be a little more patient because Tulane's play-action game is killer. And you can just see the plan. You can see the plan right off rip when they played Kansas State. Let's get Hughes the first four or five touches of the game, and then let's just work right off of it. And it's working for Tulane right now. It's a game, honestly, they'll probably tell you it's a game they should have won.
Yeah,
I believe Mensa threw a pick six that gave K-State the lead or tied the game. I think it gave them the lead when they were tied at 20, but they dominated the first half of that game. They were ahead 20-10. They feel like they should have won that game, but the biggest reason was that Mensa was able to complement Hughes with play-action shots, and that's something Oklahoma, it's not necessarily in their comfort zone. So that's what I'm looking at. Obviously, they need to get Hughes going for it to work, but Mensa's playing really, really well.
That's a great point about Oklahoma's two best defensive players in Danny Stutzman and Billy Bowman. That's the one word to describe them is aggressiveness.
Yes.
They fly to the football, which is a great thing when they're making big plays, but against a play-action team, that could be a really big negative as well. So that's a great point by you. My matchup to watch when Oklahoma has the football, Jackson Arnold, the supporting cast around him has been worrisome. And I think a lot of people have looked at, you know, Jackson Arnold's numbers and saying, oh, you know, this former five-star recruit is disappointed so far. Dalton, I think he's played fine. I think the supporting cast around him has been far, far more concerning right now. Oklahoma currently has a 57.5 team receiving grade. If that sounds low, that's because it is. It is the second worst receiving grade among Power 4 schools right now. I will say this. A big reason for that low receiving grade is the fact that Nick Anderson, Jahlil Farouk, and Jaden Gibson, all of them are banged up right now. So you got Deion Burks, who's your number one receiver, and then a whole bunch of guys that weren't expected to be the starting guys for Oklahoma this year. So that is a big reason for that. But also, those guys probably won't be playing in this game against Tulane either. So that receiving corps should still struggle in this game. The offensive line for Oklahoma has also really struggled. Right now, a 30.6% pressure rate allowed. That is 91st in the country. And the issue is, Jackson Arnold is 100th among FBS quarterbacks under pressure with a 45.6 PFF grade. He's 36th when he's kept clean with an 84.8 PFF grade. So you're talking about a quarterback who, when he's kept clean and not under pressure, he's really good. When he is under pressure, he's not very good. And the issue is your offensive line is not protecting him right now, and the receivers for Oklahoma are not stepping up. All the new guys, and again, they have the excuse of a lot of injuries right now with Nick Anderson and Jahlil Farouk and Jaden Gibson all out. But they need the supporting cast for Arnold to step up. I will say this, though. Tulane has been extremely vulnerable against passing games this year. Right now, the Green Wave have a 64.3 team coverage grade. That is 102nd in the country, and they only pressure the quarterback on 26% of their passing plays, which is 103rd in the country. So the Sooners have a little bit of a get-right game now against Tulane in this pass defense, but if they struggle once again, it really might be time to start worrying about Oklahoma's offense as they enter SEC play.
Yeah, I agree for sure, because they need to look better than they looked last week. You mentioned Houston's loss to UNLV. They got dominated by UNLV. Yeah. They were giving up big plays. They were getting beat on the ground. This Oklahoma team just looked out of rhythm last week, and I do think this game – you know, for Tulane, too, the stakes of it. Okay, they played K-State close. They were at one point, they were 8 yards from tying it again and maybe forcing overtime. It's a game they feel they should have won. I think we have to remember, too, with these group of five teams, play close or even win one of these games. Tulane, I think in maybe the old scenario of a 14 playoff, this might be a letdown game for them. I think they're going to come in here believing they can win, and they can keep this close and they can win. And they see what everybody sees with Oklahoma's offense, and they're going, listen, we just have to find ways to score enough points against the talented defense. I think it's going to be tight. I really do. I think Oklahoma has a lot they're trying to figure out right now. And you mentioned it. They need to get right before they get into SEC. If they go into SEC play, looking like they looked last week.
Tennessee next week.
If they go and play Tennessee looking like they played against Houston, that's going to be a long, long day.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dolan, you mentioned it, like Tulane, now in this new expanded playoff, Tulane thinks, okay, I picked Tulane to win the American this year. Tulane's saying, hey, we have a better non-conference schedule than pretty much every other Group of Five team. They played close against a top 15 team already in Kansas State, and if they beat a top 15 team in Oklahoma, basically all Tulane needs to do after that is maybe lose one more time and then win the American, and then they're in. They're the school.
If you're a G5 team with one loss and you swept your conference and you beat Oklahoma and you lost a really tight game to K-State, you'll get that playoff spot.
Yeah.
You'll be the number 12 team in the country for sure.
So can Tulane pull off the upset over Oklahoma, or will the Sooners get a bounce back game a little bit against Tulane?
I think this is a harder game to pick than most people would think. And Tulane played really, really well last week, and they just crashed in a couple of big moments, especially the pick six, and just then late trying to tie the game. I think they had a big penalty, a holding penalty or something that dragged them back, and then they just couldn't punch it in one last time. I have Oklahoma 27-23. I do think this game could very well go as tight as it did last week for Tulane against K-State. Oklahoma's defense, they need to come through for them right now. I think there's still going to be some rhythm that needs to be found with Jackson Arnold with this offense, and it might come down to whoever gets pressure on the quarterback, and I know it comes down to that a lot, but you have two quarterbacks right now with heavy splits between their passing performance when they're clean and when they're under pressure. So it's going to come down to a lot of things. Tulane, can they run the ball? Can Mekhi Hughes get enough yards to set up that play action? What does Oklahoma see on tape from the last 2 weeks of Tulane that they go, okay, these are the things we need to look for with this play action? Because that was the biggest thing, is Mensa making explosive plays in the passing game against K-State, and that's what got him ahead, and that's what kept him in it. Oklahoma's defense, I think right now with their offense kind of reeling a little bit, they need to be the unit that wins this game. I think they're going to do it, but I'm also a little weary on it. Tulane is a really good football team, and I thought they would have some sort of drop-off after losing all the talent they lost, especially Michael Pratt and some of the offensive crew. Chris Brazell went to Tennessee. I thought there would be a bigger drop-off, but it's a huge development in the American Conference, in the Group of Five, and really early here in the season that Darren Mensah has been so good. I have Oklahoma, though, 27-23.
Yeah, shout-out to John Summerall, too. By the way, we didn't mention it. Willie Fritz is gone. He's obviously now, ironically, the Houston coach now. And Summerall's come in and just kind of continued the success that Fritz has had. So, yeah, shout-out to him. I got Oklahoma in this game as well. I think it will be a close one. I got 27-17. I think the offense will bounce back a little bit against a vulnerable Tulane defense. And the Oklahoma defense continues to show why it's one of the better units we have in college football. But even Dalton, you know, Tulane fans hearing this might not be very happy, but even if they lose a close game to Oklahoma and they have two losses at the end of the year and they go 11-2, that still might be good enough to make the playoff.
It's at least something to think about. Yeah, if you don't get, say, a Memphis go undefeated, well, Memphis wouldn't go undefeated in that scenario, but if you don't get, say, a Boise or a UNLV to go undefeated, yep, or a Texas State to do something or something like, and these are two huge wins. You could argue they're the two biggest games, other than maybe Boise playing Oregon, that they're two of the biggest games that a Group of Five team has played and will play. So it's for them to get this win, even though they didn't get the win last week, would change everything about the outlook of what could be the end result. And I think, honestly, you picked them to win the conference. I didn't go – I went into this year when we were predicting the American, and I was like, I don't know that Tulane can recover. They need a year off, don't they, after a couple of really good seasons? But apparently they didn't. So it's huge all the way around for this playoff race.
I know ball, Dawn. I know ball. I mean, maybe you don't. That's so. I think that explains that.
Hey, the records are the same right now.
So. That's fair. But like I'm saying, like, even if Tulane loses, though, in a close game, I think they still have a shot to make the playoff. With two losses. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it will be close. I really do.
Yeah, so do I. So, yeah, I got Oklahoma in this game 27-17. Going to be a great one. Another game, Dalton, that is absolutely fascinating. The final one we're previewing today is Texas A&M at Florida, which is a 3:30 p.m. Eastern time game on ABC. The storyline to know is that these are two programs with really interesting quarterback situations right now. And quarterbacks naturally are always the players that people always pay the most attention to because they play the most important position on the field. But you need to pay even more scrutiny to the quarterbacks in this game. Florida, currently embroiled in a quarterback battle between Graham Mertz and DJ Lagway. Mertz has infinitely more experience than Lagway. He's a redshirt senior, but he was rough against Miami in that season opener. He had three turnover-worthy plays. He had six all of last season, Dawn. So he had half of the turnover-worthy plays he had all of last year in just one game. he was concussed in that loss to Miami, which led to Lagway getting the start against Samford this past weekend. He was a top-ranked quarterback in the 2024 class, Dolan, and he showed why he was a five-star in his first career start. Five big-time throws in the win over Samford, and head coach Billy Napier confirmed this week that the Gators intend to use both of them moving forward. So that's one side of the ball. Other side of the ball, you got Connor Wigman, who is undoubtedly the starter for Texas A&M, but he's got to bounce back. He's the current number one quarterback on PFS Big Board right now for the NFL draft. He had a rough showing against Notre Dame, though, with a 37.1 passing grade in the loss. And now, against Florida, who had a 51.2 coverage grade in the loss to Miami, this is the time where a lot of people are expecting Wigman to bounce back and show why he was a top quarterback prospect. And if he doesn't do that, then we got more conversations saying, hey, is he actually one of the top quarterbacks in the draft, or is he a guy that we should be moving down the big board a little bit?
This game is such a circus.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I have actually, like, obviously I can always come up with stuff and find stuff and data, but this is such a circus game. It's in the swamp with two teams that whichever one loses is going to be in something of a panic mode.
Yeah.
Right? You have both of them in week one went out and got just hammered. And I know the Notre Dame score with A&M was closer, but physically Notre Dame dominated that game and their defense was the best unit on the field. And we saw how Wigman played in that game. The stories are abound. I don't even know if we call it a quarterback battle in Gainesville, or I mean, Billy Napier said he's going to play both of them, which I don't know. I mean, usually you if you're playing two guys, you have two guys with completely different skill sets, and I know Lagway moves more, but I don't know where we're at with the Gators quarterback situation, honestly, because Lagway was so good last week, and I think he brings things to the table. Graham Mertz is a really good quarterback, and he doesn't lose you ball games, and normally he doesn't turn the ball over like he did against Miami, but at a certain point here, the Florida Gators have to start winning games. They've had three losing seasons in a row, and I didn't expect them to go out there and look the way they did against Miami. So the quarterback thing on both sides of this, this honestly, just for all of the circumstances surrounding it and how neither team played well in their first game of the year against a real team, this might be the most unpredictable game. I have no idea what to make of this on the whole. When you just go, okay, how's this game going to go in the swamp between these two teams? And I go, it could go any which way possible. Honestly, it's a weird one.
So both teams look rough in the season opener, and then both teams won the next game. But Florida played Samford, and Texas A&M played McNeese State. So it's like this is the first time, really, since week one that we're seeing these two teams tested once again.
We had 2 weeks of practice essentially, and then we get to see them against each other. And they, I don't think they could be playing each other for both programs at a weirder time.
No.
Especially Florida. Look, A&M's under first-year head coach Mike Elko. I think he knew they were going to come in and have to work on things. There was a lot of turnover and a lot of fallout from Jimbo Fisher being fired and all of that. Florida, this could be a game that one way or the other changes their program.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's that big despite them already having a loss on the record.
So, Dolan, you had Connor Wigman in this game against the Florida defense. What should we be looking out for in his hopefully for him, bounce back game?
Yeah, look, we'll stay with the quarterbacks because that's the story in this game. Wigman, he's got tools. He's got a big arm. He's got a lot of potential. But we have yet to see him really show that against Power 5, Power 4, however many powers there are competition in his career. And look, in the games in his career against Power 5 competition, a 59.9 passing grade compared to against non-Power 5 competition, could be G5, could be FCS. Against that competition, he's got a 94.5 passing grade. He looks like the best quarterback in the country. But it can't come crashing this far back down when you start playing equivalent opponents. Now, the Notre Dame game is one thing. That's one of the best defenses in the country, despite even the loss to Northern Illinois. That's one of the 3 to 5 best defenses in the country. A lot of quarterbacks are going to look like that against Notre Dame. But we've seen him last year before he got hurt against Auburn, kind of rattled, up and down against Miami. You could go back to the freshman year. It's kind of not fair because he's starting the last 5 or 6 games of his freshman year. But at some point, we have to see this ability in the games that matter. Right, and you talk about non-Power 5 competition, big-time throw rate, 9.7%. Power 5, 3.1. Turnover-worthy play rate almost doubles. Yards per attempt almost cut in half. The yards per attempt is 10.1 against non-Power 5 teams. So clearly, when he has the opportunity and things are easy, it's very easy for him. He has the ability. And I think this Florida secondary, if you were going to do it against a Power 5 team, Well, this Florida secondary is the one you want to do it against. I've shown you enough of the tape and, the breakdowns on it. But no, I mean, look, there are reasons that the only team in the SEC last year with a worse coverage grade was Vanderbilt. And those trends just continued against Cam Ward in Miami. And I know Cam Ward in Miami look like a wagon right now, but it was the same thing. I saw the same thing. It was mistakes. I don't think it's that the Gators aren't talented. They make mistakes. They make a ton of mistakes. And you just can't. You have to go out and execute no matter how much talent you have. The other X factor for Wigman, okay, there's constants in a guy's game, knowing what he's good at. And then there's those variables where you walk into a game and you go, can he do this today? Mm-hmm. And can he get better in practice at this and bring it to the games? He's fantastic throwing over the middle of the field. No question. He's one of, over the middle third of the field, one of the best passers in the country. But the games, and that exact split in Power 5 games, when he has to start getting outside of that, getting out towards the numbers, throwing the ball down the sideline or towards the sideline, it's just not as good. And you see it. In the easy games, he's willing to let it rip out there. But let's take against Notre Dame 2 weeks ago. He was fine throwing over the middle. You saw slants, you saw in cuts, you saw seam routes, things like that. That's fine. When he had to throw to the outer two-thirds of the field, right, if you cut the field into three roughly 18-yard increments, right, 50 should be 54 yards. That bothers me. Oh, that's an OCD thing. That bothers me. That's 53 instead of 54. But anyway, take the outer two-thirds of the field away from the middle. In that game, a 29.7 passing grade. You have to be able to expand the whole field. And I know the middle of the field is the trendy thing, and that's where we want to attack and in play action and moving linebackers and safeties. And it's really important. It is. But you have to be somewhat effective outside towards the numbers, too. And Wigman, when he has struggled, has not been able to expand that bubble of this 15 to 20-yard range and sometimes the deep balls of just, okay, you can make the throws right in front of you. I need you to fix your footwork and make the big throws. He's got the arm. It's not that he can't get it out there. He's got a really good arm. He was a baseball player. But there's a stark difference in his good games and his bad games of that bubble gets expanded, and he can make throws outside towards the numbers, and he uses all 53 yards. When he doesn't, it looks maybe not as bad as against Notre Dame because that's just a killer defense that he was playing, but it looks closer to that than it does in the games like we saw last week against, was it McNeese? Yeah, it was McNeese, where he, I think right at the moment, but I don't know if it's been reviewed yet, but he had like a 97 grade last week against McNeese. Yeah. I know he can beat McNeese. I'm aware. He's got to come out here and throw the ball one outside towards the numbers and succeed with that and beat this Gators team that really struggles in coverage.
Absolutely. And Dalton, on the other side of the ball, it really is about the quarterbacks in this game. And it's just, how does Billy Napier handle this quarterback controversy? And, you know, you mentioned it. You said, okay, usually when you play two quarterbacks, it's because they have two different, very different play styles. And while they're a little similar in that, you know, Graham Mertz is not really a mobile threat. And Lagway can run. He's not an elite rusher, but he can run. They are completely different in terms of how they throw the ball. Graham Mertz is the veteran of the group. He will take care of the football, but also he is not going to push that ball downfield. Last year, he had a 1.4% turnover-worthy play rate. That was third among all quarterbacks in the country behind only Bo Nix and Drew Aller. But his 6.7-yard average depth of target was also the third lowest in the country as well. So he's not pushing the ball downfield at all. He takes care of the football, but he's not pushing the ball downfield. Lagway has the more potential of the two with his physical tools. He kind of lacks the experience that Mertz has, though, as just a true freshman, and kind of that, you know, youthful ignorance that you have. Like, hey, I want to go out there. I'm going to let it rip, man, against Stanford. He had five big-time throws in that game against Stanford. Currently, a 15.2% big-time throw rate on the season. That is the highest in the country. He also leads the country with a 15.2-yard average depth of target. So you're talking about Graham Mertz, who is very safe, not going to push the ball downfield, take what's there. Lagway's like, no, F that, man. I'm going to go out and let it rip. And that's what he did against Stanford. So really, two quarterbacks who couldn't be different as passers, with one who's ultra-conservative and one who, at least in one game that we saw, is going to go out there and let it rip. It's going to be really interesting to see, I guess, a good Texas A&M defense, too, how Florida employs these two quarterbacks.
First of all, I think Youthful Ignorance is the name of my next album, just so we're clear. That's great stuff. I need to know the cutoff of how old you have to be before it's not just youthful ignorance anymore. Anyway, I think it's a weird one right now. I mean, they're saying they're going to play both of them. Wouldn't you just be more comfortable if they just picked one way or the other?
Who would you pick, by the way? I think we got to talk
about it. I would pick Lagway.
So would I.
I just think the physical ability, we know what Graham Mertz is, and it's not that Graham Mertz is bad. Graham Mertz is reliable more than anything, and he won't lose you ball games. But I don't think this Florida team is loaded enough to just go with a quarterback that doesn't lose you ball games, right? You know, when you think about it's a great trait to have, but eventually this is a team that needs a quarterback that can elevate them. And if Lagway is that number one recruit and he's that five-star guy and he's – I mean, he showed – there, he made multiple throws last week that Mertz I don't think is capable of
no,
making.
No, physically not capable.
Physically not capable. And again, it's a different style. And you have playmakers. You have Trey Wilson. And you have, say, if you're taking safeties off with a threat of a – just a threat of a deep ball. Mm-hmm. And then you open things up front for Montrell Johnson to run the ball. And even Lagway's a decent athlete, right, who could run the ball a few times himself. You don't get the mobility with Mertz, and you don't get that level of arm where, look, there's sometimes it's not just receivers. It's, look, sometimes you have to try a deep ball just to get them off you. Right? It's that sort of thing. I would go with Lagway all the way through. I know Mertz is a veteran. I know you don't want to take a guy's job because he got hurt. I understand that. But to rotate between two, it's something we've talked about with SMU lately, right? Now they've at least finally picked one. You know, it's a weird dynamic, and it's a weird thing when you're trying to get either one, a rhythm passer, Graham Mertz, into a rhythm, or two, a really young kid in Lagway into a rhythm. It also makes for the amount of mystery that's in this game, because we have no idea. Is it one drive? Is it two drives? Is it back and forth the whole game? Is it hot hand? Whatever that means sometimes. Which way does this? I would go with Lagway on the physical tools alone. I think the Gators, they're already trying to throw a Hail Mary to save their season, but I don't know that a two quarterback system is the way to go.
And it doesn't the fact they're already playing a two quarterback system in week three say this Lagway, Lagway's closer to winning his job than
they wouldn't have done it if Mertz didn't get hurt.
Right.
It's not. It would be Graham Mertz's team still, which is the awkward part of the team dynamic and leadership, and Mertz is a senior and all of that. They certainly wouldn't. It would still be Mertz's job, I think, for at least a few more games before maybe they turn to Lagway or they see how the A&M game goes and the UCF game goes or however that goes. To go from – is it an open competition?
I feel like Mertz is going to start, and then it'll be a quick hook if he struggles.
Okay, is it because that's the thing? Is it more of that thing? Because are they both guaranteed to play?
I don't know. He said we're going to play both of them. That was the exact words that Billy Napier said. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means drive in, drive out, or what that means. But Dolan also
mean the other one comes in for victory formation. I mean, yeah,
it's weird. It's very weird. And also that's a great on field breakdown of why I agree with you. Why Lagway should be in there, because he unlocks a part of the offense that simply Graham Mertz, as much as we like him, he's physically incapable of unlocking that part of the offense that Lagway can. There's an off the field reason too. Billy Napier is kind of in survival mode right now. He is desperate to give this program hope for the future. Graham Mertz is a redshirt senior, is not your future. The true freshman, number one quarterback in the country coming out of high school, that is your future. And for Billy Napier, who is, like I said, in preservation mode right now, he can go to them and say, hey, listen, if I'm not here, he might not be here either. This kid committed to me. So if I'm not here, he might enter the portal. That's another off-field reason why I think Lagway – I know it's nothing to do with on the field.
And there's a lot more. There's the cash, and there's everything else, the buyouts and everything that goes into that. And then there's the fans and what they're calling for. So it makes more sense to me that Lagway would be the guy. I understand it's always terrible if a guy's
going to – Mertz is good.
Yeah.
He's a good quarterback. You know, it's not like he's a bad quarterback.
It reminds me – but we've seen this before, right? I mean, I can go all the way back to Jim Harbaugh and the 49ers when Alex Smith got hurt and Colin Kaepernick then – When do we take him out? And then they just never took him out, and they went to a Super Bowl. Like, we have seen this before in other situations. Go back to Tom Brady and Drew Bledsoe. So, well, I guess we have to leave Tom in here because we're just not – and they won a Super Bowl. So if I'm not saying the Gators are going to make a playoff run or anything, but at some point you just – look what he – if Lagway had played an average game last week, I'd go, okay, just go back.
But yeah.
Spectacular.
And, Dawn, the thing is, too, is like we know with that schedule for Florida, with Graham Mertz at quarterback
– they need a ceiling.
They're not making a bowl game probably with Graham Mertz at quarterback with that schedule. With Lagway, we don't know what's going to happen. This kid could be the absolute superstar from day one, and all of a sudden, this Florida team that we thought, okay, they're not making a bowl game, now all of a sudden, you got to recalibrate. So I think that's another thing, too, where it's like, with Graham Mertz, you know exactly what you're getting, and what you're getting against that schedule is probably not going to be enough. With Lagway, we don't know what we're getting. So I think that's a whole different thing, too.
At least we don't know what we don't know. But for all of that that we just explained, I'm gonna take A&M.
Okay.
I think had they picked a quarterback by now, just one or the other, just so we know.
Yeah,
I would probably pick Florida, but that scares me. It does. At least I know who Texas A&M's quarterback is, even if he struggles in these spots and he's got to get better. I'll take Texas A&M 26-23. I honestly believe I have no idea what to expect in this game.
Neither do I.
I think you have two teams that are really, really trying to find it, and I'll take A&M. The one thing for A&M, they need Skorton and the pass rush to be better. If they can be better than they've been the first 2 weeks, I like A&M in this game. And just for I don't know what to expect. I don't know what to expect from this Gators offense. I really don't know, because we don't know who's starting. We don't know how much each is going to play or what style of ball they're going to play. I'm not sure. So I have to take A&M just as the known commodity.
I hope they start Lagway. I really do, because I mean, there's a lot of Florida fans right now are saying, hey, this could be the best quarterback we have since Tim Tebow. Right, so that's a high praise for maybe the greatest college quarterback of all time. But yeah, I got A&M winning this game as well, 31-17. I think the combination of Connor Wigman against a very, very vulnerable Florida defense that we saw in that Miami game already, and then the uncertainty under center for Florida right now, that could lead to the Gators offense being static against a good Aggie defense as well. I got 31-17. I got Texas A&M winning this game, but I am fascinated as to what the heck Florida does at quarterback and how Connor Wigman looks against Florida's defense as well, and whether or not he can bounce back after a rough week one. So that wraps up our previews for the week, Dawn, but we still have to give out our upset picks of the week. And Dawn, you and I are the host of the show, but we are falling behind our producer right now. I have zero points in the upset pick of the week.
I don't know why he's not just sitting here.
He should be.
Yeah.
Well, he should be back there pushing the buttons.
Yeah.
Eli has hit both of his upset picks right now with 314 points. You have 102 points. You're 1-1 in your upset pick. So just a reminder to people how the point total is made. We're picking a team to win in an upset, and whatever their money line is the amount of points we get if they end up pulling out the victory. So Eli, again, has hit both of his so far. I should have hit mine past week.
We both had some rough finishes, man.
Mine was way worse.
Yours was worse, but we both had some rough ones. I thought I nailed it with Tulsa, and they were up early, and then just too many penalties for Tulsa. The penalties killed them. And you, that was just...
screaming in your car.
That was a circus. Oh yeah,
yeah.
That was hilarious. But who do we want?
Let's go
with the hot hand first. Yeah. What has he got for us?
So I've made a last minute switch. I'm going to go East Carolina +114 against Appalachia State. I don't like a lot of the board this week. A lot of the upsets, I'm just not a big fan of, especially games we're not talking about. Trying to stick away from that. But I think East Carolina has got a hot offense. They haven't played a lot of guys yet, but Appalachia State kind of struggling out of the gate. They just got smacked by Clemson, so maybe this is a comeback spot for them. But I kind of like East Carolina as a dog at home.
Siobhan Revelle, too.
Siobhan Revelle.
Could be a first-round pick.
Jake Garcia at quarterback.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Jake Garcia is still in college. It's crazy. I like it. All right, +114. You guys going East Carolina.
Going with a tighter one. I mean, App State against Clemson. That was a rough one. They're coming off a rough one. They might be bruised up. I could see that. That's reasonable.
What are you going with here?
I'm going to a team that Eli had a couple weeks ago. I'm going to North Texas. Denton, Texas. North Texas over Texas Tech at +260. I've mentioned Chandler Morris before on this show. He's looked really, really good. Made five big-time throws this past week against Stephen F. Austin. Got the 11th highest overall grade in the country among quarterbacks right now. Chandler Morris has this North Texas offense high-flying. Texas Tech coming off of a razor-thin victory 2 weeks ago against Abilene Christian and went up to Oregon State and lost. They were without Taj Brooks in that game. He was out with an arm injury. Right now, they're saying he's trending in the right direction, but he's officially questionable as of what I'm aware of right this minute, has some sort of arm injury. They also lost one of their starting guards. But the bigger thing to me, Chandler Morris, 11th best overall grade in the country right now. Texas Tech has the lowest coverage grade of any team in the nation. right now. It's like somewhere around a 33 or 34. They're really struggling on the back end. They have a lot of injuries. Their injury report, if you look at it, that came out earlier today, is just stacked with names, including Taj Brooks. And obviously, if Brooks were to be out, I would feel really, really good about this pick because he's the center of the whole team, right? So I think Chandler Morris and North Texas, we're going back to the mean green. I think they go into Texas Tech and get a win.
Plus 260, you're going. That's a big one. I like it.
I think they're 9-point underdogs in that game, I want to say.
I went for a big one last week. I am just trying to get on the board right now. So I'm going with Texas State plus 105 over Arizona State in this game. Texas State was, I think, both of our picks to win the Sun Belt this year, weren't they?
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, we both picked them to win the Sun Belt. They beat Lamar week one by only 7 points, which is not great. But then they absolutely destroyed UTSA in week two by 39 points. And a lot of people think UTSA is be one of the better teams in the American this year.
That's a big win for Texas State, too. Out of conference, UTSA is generally a good team and was supposed to be good again this year. And that was a tight game, too. That was only – I think it went into it with a 1 or 2 point spread. I thought that was going to be a tighter game. I was worried about Texas State even winning that game, and they dominated.
They are so talented on both sides of the ball. And then Arizona State on the other side, you know, they beat Wyoming by 41, but Wyoming has looked rough so far this year. And then they beat Mississippi State last week by 7. I think Mississippi State's going to be one of the worst teams in the SEC this year. So I don't think that says too much about Arizona State. So I think Texas State, with all the Jordan McCloud and Ismail Mahdi and Ben Bell, who's a monster edge defender for Texas State, I think they're going to go. It's a home game for Texas State as well. Thursday night game as well. So that'll be fun.
Short turnaround, too, because didn't they play a late game with Mississippi State, too?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
It's a short turnaround.
It is. So, yeah, that helps me as well. And again, I'm trying to get on the board right now. And this is a game that I actually think Texas State was going to win. Last week, I did not think Arkansas was ultimately going to win, but I thought that the money line was too juicy not to take it. This one, I'm like, okay, Texas State, I think, is going to beat Arizona State.
You didn't want to take the swing on Kentucky beating Georgia?
No, I wouldn't. And listen, if we were allowed to pick out of these games right here, I would take an Arizona. Arizona's like plus 260 right now.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Against Kansas State.
The other ones I thought about, actually, the other big one I thought about was Memphis over Florida State. Was
I like
a thought
that.
For sure. After a week off, we need to see what Florida State looks like. And, man, I almost went with UNLV again against Kansas. I think that's going to be a fun game on Friday night. You got the K-State-Arizona game on Friday. It only odd to me that K-State and Kansas both playing on Friday night and both at home. So close together.
Yeah.
It seems odd to me for that area and those two schools so close together that their games are at the same time. But I don't make the schedule, obviously.
Kansas, for the first time ever, might be electric on Friday night. That'd be a lot of fun.
Let me think. You know what's weird with Kansas? They're playing – I think they're still playing this game at the soccer stadium, like Sporting KC or something.
Oh, how
and then all of their conference home games are at Arrowhead this year.
Love that. Because
they're renovating their stadium. So they're going to get to play. We'll see if Colorado – like later in the year, it's Kansas-Colorado at Arrowhead Stadium.
Yeah.
Think about that. Hopefully they're both still relevant by then.
Yeah. So I like those picks. I think I'm really hoping I just get on the board right now. I know I'm not going for a juicy one. I know plus 105 is not great, but – I think Texas State is going to win.
You got to get off the schneid.
I got to get that goose egg next to my name. I got to get rid of that right now. So I'm going Texas State as my upset pick. That's what we got, though, for our preview of the six biggest games in week three. Once again, on Sunday morning, we will be going over a lot of these games, plus anything else that happens in a chaotic week of college football that we always have, that we always get. Dawn will be going to a wedding this weekend, so he'll be very tired on a Sunday morning, but we will be here Sunday morning to break it all down for you. Big thanks to our producers, Eli and Sav, back there, and we will see you guys on Sunday morning for our week three review show.